Welcome to the Financial Literacy Bootcamp, where certified financial planner Dominique Henderson discusses financial topics in plain English for the investing public. Dominique is the owner and founder of DJH Capital Management, LLC, a fee-only registered investment advisory firm offering comprehensive financial planning and wealth management services to entrepreneurs. You can visit them on the web at www.djh-capital.com or on social media by the hashtag Financial Literacy Bootcamp. Now here's the host of the Financial Literacy Bootcamp, Dominique Henderson.
Welcome to the Financial Literacy Bootcamp. I'm your host, Dominique Henderson, and the Financial Literacy Bootcamp is designed to help the financial services industry to become more relevant, reliable, and respected to those we intend to serve. So we do that each week by describing financial topics in plain English for the investing public. So trying a little new stuff here out of our comfort zone. Maven's Keys was transitioned to video. And so we are going to attempt this. It's a little bit more difficult. I tend to be a little bit more technical on this podcast. I tend to sometimes give things that can be construed as financial advice, although I always make the disclaimer whenever I'm doing financial advice type stuff that this is not personal financial planning advice. You need to go seek the help of a professional if you want that. Don't take this as, you know, stock advice or whatnot. So anyway, we'll see how this works. I'm using new software. I'm totally out of my comfort zone right now, but it's all good. Hopefully the audio's good. And even if you don't like looking at my face, you can get the iTunes version or, Stitcher or something like that and download and just listen to it. So today we're going to be talking about the evolution of the retirement landscape, and been doing a lot of reading, fact checking and stuff like that, just listening to other people. So I'll try to not ramble too much on this, but I recently penned an article on Executive Comp, A Guide to Building Wealth, and that's available by request at info@djh-capital.com. So if you're, C-level suite executive, you have employer benefits and executive comp, you make beyond 270, which is the IRS limit. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. You may want to get the article because there's some interesting strategy tips there. But anyways, I wanted to use a podcast segment to highlight a couple of things I talked about in that article and also give a more macro view of the what's just happening in the retirement landscape. And so we'll begin with, let's begin with the IRS limits. So there's basically a couple of ways to look at this. So the IRS is out, well, specifically the Treasury Department is had uses the Internal Revenue Code to collect money to fund our government, yada, 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 all that kind of stuff like that. So that's where the IRS's power comes from, is to enforce the code, which has been changed so many times over the years. That's not really the scope of this podcast. But the point is that they have sections in there, and I'm not familiar exactly with the sections. I'm just familiar with the top-down view. In that the imposed limits they have are to redirect your what they called income from all sources, all attributions to your wealth, all increases in your wealth. There's basically two buckets that you need to think about, is qualified bucket and the non-qualified bucket. So the limits that they impose on contributions are to help all the money that should not go into the qualified bucket, which is basically not taxed during the time it's there, to impose a limit in order to make the overflow or the portion that you can't put into the qualified bucket fall into the non-qualified bucket so that they can tax it. That's the basic premise around their limits. And so they get adjusted every year for inflation and things like that. But currently the limit on defined benefit plans, which in just a second, I'll give you the difference between defined benefit and defined contribution plans, if you don't know that already. but we're breaking it down in plain English, remember. So the limit on defined benefit plans is 215. So that means 215,000, which means that if you are a participant in a defined benefit plan, like a pension plan or something like that, money purchase, all those different plans. I can't think of all of them right now, but the point is that no more than $215,000 per year can be contributed on your behalf. So usually most employers use a formula. So it's like, for instance, I know that teacher retirement system, TRS, uses a formula that's basically your top 5 years of salary times some type of rate, like a percent, then your years of service. So it's usually a calculation like that. That can't exceed 215 as far as contributions are concerned. And then there's another limit. So if you make over 270, which teachers don't, but like if you're an ExxonMobil executive, you make over 270, but only $270,000 of your comp can be considered in that calculation. So what happens if you make over that, right? There's a question, because if you make over that and you're living off over that, how do you save more? Well, it has to go into a non-qualified plan, which is where executive comp comes in and yada, yada, yada. So with defined contribution plans, it's lower. It's $54,000. That's what can be contributed on the behalf of an employer for 2017. And these are all 2017 numbers, by the way. The employer can contribute $36,000 and the employee can salary defer $18,000, which is a great way to reduce your taxable income. Whole different podcast. Go out there and search financial literacy boost, the hashtag financial literacy bootcamp. And I kind of cover that in some other podcasts around 18, episode 18, something like that. Anyways, so that 18 plus that 36 is the 54 of contributions that can be made on your behalf. And now if you're 50 or older, you can make an extra 6,000, but it's still under the 54, meaning that the employer's contribution would just be reduced by 30. So there you have it. There's the limits on that and what have you. But let's talk about what those limits impose, what it kind of means. And I kind of got to this and, kind of alluded to this. So if you're making over 270, which I know a lot of you may not be, but just work with me here. The point is if you're making over the limit that the IRS imposes, you have to find other ways to supplement your retirement income during your retirement, right? Because you won't be able to save enough through a qualified plan. And then you got to even think about the fact that you get taxed on that money too. So there's got to be other ways to do this. And so that's where financial advice comes in to kind of create strategies around that. Because your number one goal while you're working, and I'm going to get into this because the survey of consumer finances that the Federal Reserve Board conducts is very interesting because they have some stuff in there. But your number one reason for working, people say, or this survey says, is they save and invest because they want to fund their retirement. And so you've got to think about two things. You got to think about how do you increase your potential for wealth while you're working? How do this exchange of human capital that I've talked about before, in most cases, on average, it'd be about 80,000 hours during your working career. You exchange that for money, and that money has got to last you not only the time that you're living, but your time that you're living before retirement, pre-retirement, and post-retirement. So you got to save enough money to fund both of those sections of your life. And you want to minimize your tax burden. So that's where financial advice comes in, because of all the different complexity and variety of plans and the resulting strategies that can be implemented on behalf of a plan participant. So that's that, right? So let's go into some more stuff here. So let's say that, where do we want to go now? Let's talk about the survey of consumer finances, because I think that is a good start. And I'll put a article link there. It's not a short read, but you'll get the gist of it in the first couple pages. So in 2004, I think I read this during my grad study. So 2004-ish, I read this study where, they found that individuals save and invest primarily to fund their retirement. So if you just kind of think about what we've been talking about, the IRS limits on how much you can contribute to a qualified plan, which increases every year, but only at a very slow rate. And if you're making over 270, that can be a problem. And then we'll start looking at, and I promised you a definition that for the difference between defined contributions and defined benefit plans. So here we go. Because there's been an evolution, and that's what this podcast is talking about. So defined benefit means you have a defined benefit over the course of your retirement that you've earned while you've worked, based on maybe that formula that I gave you. So years of service times some type of rate times your highest 5 years of salary, something like that. But employers over the last 3 to 4 decades, since the late 70s or so, have shifted away from that defined benefit because it cost them a lot of money. If you just think about all the people that would come through a particular company or employer and you being responsible for supplying their retirement benefits, you know, as I say, once they start working 10, 15 years, you're on the hook, then that is a lot of money. And so they've shifted that to defined contribution, which means your retirement income is now made up of all the contributions that you make, mostly employee, and some of the contributions that we make as an employer, if we choose. So they're not on the hook. That's the main difference, is the law for defined benefit plans is different than the law around defined contribution plans. If the employer has a defined benefit plan, they have to, obligations, they have to make those obligations. If it's a defined contribution plan, they are not on the hook. So there's no liability. And that's a really big difference, because if you look at a financial statement, on the liability section will be the amount of money they owe to their retirees. If they have a defined contribution plan, there will be no liability there. So that's a big thing when you start thinking about from a macro view with, you know, how things have changed, the globalization in this world, and how profit margins have shrank because of increased cost of labor and just all these different factors. I'm not going to go into all those right now, but for the most part, we've got the same pie. And through globalization, we have the same size pie, but it's sliced into so many more pieces. And so that means lower profits for companies, which means that they have to find a way to save costs, which is largely their largest cost by far is, you know, the employee benefits and salaries and whatnot. That's a very high fixed cost. Combine that with the fact that over the last decade and a half, especially since the recession, we have gotten lower investment returns overall. You can just Google stuff about the loss period in the S&P and things like that. The point is, the traditional ways of investment, and I'm going to have to do a whole nother podcast, and let me try to get into this real quick. So the traditional ways of investment was that an employer would hire an actuary to figure out the benefits. They would hire a big investment management firm, and they go through all these formulas and whatnot to figure out how much they're going to pay out per retiree, depending on how long they think they're going to live on average, right? And a large portion of that sum of money was invested in fixed income products and things like that that paid better rates of return. Well, fixed income doesn't pay that good of returns right now. I mean, interest rates are really low. Just look at the 10-year treasury or anything like that. Well, that lower investment return overall means that you have to have a larger pool of money set aside for retirees, because you're making less on the money that's in that pool, if that makes sense. So bigger retiree pool, less investment returns mean you got to put more aside, per the law at least. So what it basically meant is that you had a lot of impetus for corporations shifting from those type of plans. And it's the natural question. The next logical question, you know, is how equipped is the average investor to take the place of an actuary, an investment firm, a professionally managed investment return and firm to generate returns that are going to fund their retirement? And the answer is probably not that well equipped. I work with a lot of smart people. I know there's a lot of smart people out there, but at the end of the day, you're not paid. Your skill set is not to try to figure out your retirement. That's what I come into picture for. And the other 76,000 CFPs and other people like that, that have designations. So that are experts in this field. Point being, can you, with the evolving retirement landscape, can you have a successful retirement without the proper financial advice? And I would say the answer is probably no. So you have to really think really hard about, you know, what your reason would be for not outsourcing some of that. I just want to read a couple things to you before we close up today that have something to do with what I found through that survey of consumer finances, because they do this every so often. And so I'll put the link to the one I'm reading from in the show notes, and then you can kind of go do some more research on your own if you want. But they were just saying that there's a couple things that stood out along the lines of backing up the current premise that we have about this evolving retirement landscape and how it's going to be different for people in retirement, coming up to retirement, how you're going to fund that, what kind of strategies you're going to put in place in order to have a successful retirement, all the things that are at stake that you love and hold dear. You don't want that jeopardized because you haven't put a good plan in place. So retirement plan participation in 2013 continued on the downward trajectory observed between 2007 and 2010 for surveys for families in the bottom half of the income distribution. So if you kind of think about, you know, if you could kind of think of a bell curve, if you will, and I don't have my whiteboard today, and I'm sorry to draw, but a bell curve meaning that, you know, 45 to 50,000 is probably going to be the average household. So you're talking about people lower than that. Their retirement plan participation in 2013 continued a downward trajectory. And that makes sense because, you know, I don't know what the latest numbers are, but a lot of people, a large majority of the population has like less than $10,000 in their 401k. It says participation rebounded slightly for upper middle income families, but it did not move back to levels observed since 2007. I bet you that's because of the recession. People got skittish. People got scared. And that's just because, you know, there's so much financial news and noise out there that people don't really know what to listen to. And then you're going to give them that as a source for how they should invest their retirement savings. That's like a big deal. So that's why people in my field come along to help counsel and coach. Here's another thing that kind of stood out to me. It said much of the decline in debt. So we're shifting from retirement savings to debt, but it's related. Much of the decline in debt can be explained by a large decline in the fraction of families with home secured debt, which fell from 47% to 42%, almost 43%. A decline that is only partly explained by the small drop in home ownership. I mean, kind of, if you're reading through the study, what I kind of figured from this is yes, a lot of people lost their homes in the recession and they did not decide to go secure another home loan. And that could be juxtaposed to a lot of different things. Maybe you're trying to pay down debt. Maybe you're in deeper debt, like credit card debt and things like that. So this, the decline in debt was kind of good, kind of bad, kind of good in the fact that people on an average are carrying less debt, but why are they carrying less debt is kind of where that's pointing to. And I think there's a lot of different reasons. And it could be that they're using current income to pay down debt that they had maybe developed through the recession or maybe other years. But the point being is that money's not going to retirement if it's going to debt, right? So that kind of just kind of fills in the gaps on where you would kind of think that this thing is going. You know, we may have this bigger population of people retiring that will have to work. They're at retirement years, but they can't retire, so they have to work longer and things like that. So let's wind this up with a couple of other points to consider. Bring this thing for a landing. So one thing that I came across a lot that I think is maybe good for you to think about is lump sum distributions. So all the things that I said today point to, and this is research that you can look up, but this points to companies. If companies are shifting away from defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans, they're trying to save costs. And that's because the amount of money that they are on the hook for because of the defined benefit plans that they've had in place over, over the years, it points to an unfunded pension crisis, which has been written about. If you can just Google it, you can see what I'm talking about. But unfunded pensions in America is a big deal. And so combine that with the fact that we've been in such a low interest rate environment, if you're offered a lump sum, you may want to sit down with somebody like myself to really consider that, because it could be a win-win in that the company's getting what they want in retirement savings and saving the cost of, you know, giving you full benefits and all this other kind of stuff, and just writing you a lump sum check. You diversify that amount of money and, you know, put a plan in place. And I've seen some cases in even which when people were offered the lump sum, they took it, and 6-9 months later, they're back as a consultant part-time with that same company. So it could be a win-win. You know, you get the reduced hours, the company gets to save money, and you can probably look at that a different way. But I think the point is, do you want to be, do you want to have the liability, the risk, take the risk of not taking the lump sum, meaning that the company is on the hook to pay you. But if they come upon hard times and they can't pay you and they go bankrupt, then there is no money to pay you, versus you taking the lump sum and going and investing that in a diversified portfolio. So that's something that has to be evaluated. You know, there's tax implications sometimes and all that other kind of stuff. I guess I'll touch really, really briefly on, a portion of executive comp that seems to be, let's just say it's what I see the most often. And these would be like incentive stock options or non-qualified stock options, both of them, and restricted stock. So generally speaking, you should probably try to hold these as long as you can, especially if you're in a situation where you know you're going to be at the company for a while, the company's doing well. Actually, Ashvin Chhabra, of the Aspirational Investor, writes about how, ironically enough, you know, keeping this type of idiosyncratic concentrated risk inside your portfolio is a way to build wealth in your aspirational bucket. However, I'll caveat that with saying that if you have a highly concentrated position, let's say, you know, all this wealth is tied up in, you know, options and restricted stock or stock appreciation rights or whatever, it's all tied up in your portfolio and it's like 90% of your retirement portfolio and you're getting close to retirement, I don't know if that's a good idea. I would think about diversifying that. So you sit down, obviously, with a financial advisor or expert, and you can even call into the office. We'll take a look at that situation for you. But the point is there's a different rubric to apply depending on your situation. I would even say in the case that you have debt tied to non-appreciation your assets, you can even look at that as an opportunity to maybe diversify yourself and, you know, sell some of that stock. And granted, it's going to be, if it's executive comp, that means it's more than likely in a non-qualified type position. So you're going to have some, you know, basically like W-2 income or short-term gains that are involved. But there's all different types of strategy like tax loss harvesting that you can do to kind of offset that, generate some cash and use that to pay down debt. So, man, you know, there's so much stuff to get into. I don't know that I'm gonna do a part two of this unless it's like requested. But anyways, the article by request, again, you can email me that or email me for that. I told you I'm out of my comfort zone. I'm trying to transition to slides. I'm trying to do all this different kind of stuff. Anyways, that would be how that particularly, that thing would go. If you want the executive comp, A Guide to Building Wealth, you can definitely email me for that. Hey, and if you like what we're doing, even though we're fumbling through it, if you like what we're doing, please write us a review on iTunes. You can also review or get more information from our website, www.djh-capital.com. DJHendersonSR.com is the blog where we're posting, you know, this podcast and other articles and things like that. On social media, hashtag Financial Literacy Bootcamp. That's how you can find us, and we're doing all kinds of stuff during the week. So, and like I said, contact info, 214-699-7599, email address info@djh-capital.com. As always, have a great and prosperous day. Take care.